This is the State of Things from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you very much. It is summer. School is out. Later in the show, we're going to have some music to entertain our young audience members and their parents from Greensboro's premier rock band for kids, Big Bang Boom, is here. But first, Liz Seymour is here, and I want to introduce you to her because Liz lived a happy, comfortable, middle-class life in Greensboro. She owned a house with her husband, raised two daughters, and wrote about the Triad's furniture and home decor industry for many national publications, including the New York Times. So it's hard to explain exactly how, in her 50s, she found herself divorced, living in an anarchist group home with her foster son, and dumpster diving for food. It wasn't an overnight transformation, but a journey into what she calls her right-sized life. One constant in both her middle-class and anarchist lives was activism and engagement in her community. Liz had worked hard before her divorce to help feed people who are homeless. But afterwards, she curtailed her writing and threw herself into helping establish Greensboro's first day center for people managing homelessness. That day center is now a reality. It's called the Interactive Resource Center, and Liz is its executive director. And I'm pleased to welcome Liz Seymour to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank.
Good to have you here, Liz. So you grew up in New Hampshire, right? You went to college in New England. What brought you to Greensboro?
My former husband still lives here and teaches at Greensboro Day School. We moved down here in 1979. It was about as hot on the day we moved down here as it is today. Wondered what on earth we were thinking. And my older daughter was 6 months old at the time. I don't think either of us realized that where you move when you have a baby is often where you stay, just because it's you just start putting down roots. So that was almost 34 years ago.
Two daughters, living mm-hmm. a pretty middle-class life, and in fact, you started writing at that time, right?
That's right.
How did you manage that, and what made you decide that would be a good idea? Because it's tough enough just being a mom, right?
Well, I needed a job one way or the other, and I preferred to do something that I could do on my own and around my daughter's schedule, so we actually started out our married life at a boarding school up in Pennsylvania, so we had room and board taken care of. This is before I got pregnant. So I just went to the library every day and looked at books on how to be a freelance writer. This is long before the internet.
And those books really work, huh?
Apparently so.
Because you got a job.
Apparently so. The first story I sold was to a newsletter for purchasing executives. And I called up a purchasing executive, and I said, "Do you do anything interesting?" And he said, "Well, as a matter of fact, we have this thing that we're doing." I wrote it up, and I got paid $40 for it. And I thought, man, I have hit the jackpot. We were living in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. I don't know how many of you have visited Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, but I pitched a travel story to the New York Times travel section. And they said, you know, it's interesting. Nobody has ever pitched a travel story on Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania before.
Fancy that.
So they bought it. And so and after that I thought, this is easy. It's not easy, but.
But you were doing, and you were doing stories for the Times.
Yeah.
And then carved out a niche for yourself in the home decor business. Tell us about that.
Well, moved down here and was still building a freelance career, but it was obvious that one of the big things going on was the furniture market. Twice a year, so I just kind of kept finding the right door to put my foot in and started working part-time for what was then called HFD, Home Furnishings Daily, although thank heavens it was a weekly by the time I started working for it. And I started out on the outdoor furniture beat, and then I got added the dinettes.
So. I didn't know outdoor furniture was a beat.
Yeah, it was a beat.
Wow. That's a specialty.
And it was great training as a writer and really as a human being because people are passionate about what they're passionate about. And it doesn't really matter whether it's something I find important or not. People were passionate about dinettes. And not necessarily the dinettes themselves, but there is drama in everything. And there was drama in the dinette industry. And people would talk bad about each other behind their backs, or they'd get really excited. I started working there shortly after the furniture markets take place in the spring and the fall, and I started working in the summer. So I was covering dinettes and outdoor furniture for about 4 or 5 months before I actually saw one. And then finally started going around to these showrooms and was thinking, what, this?
This is what
this is. But what had been described, and of course this was again long before the internet, so people weren't saying, well, I'll just email you a photograph of our new group. They'd say, well, just wait and come in October and see it. And then and by the time I got there, I was so pumped. I thought, you know, nobody understands just how amazing dinettes are. Well, but they really are.
Well, so what's amazing? See, but you're in a sense, you're selling yourself a little short. You're saying, well, there's so much drama, and you realize that you saw it. I mean, that's what makes a good reporter and good reporting, because 9 people could hear that and say, it's dinettes, I'm walking away. You found the drama in these stories, and you found what's interesting in them, right?
Well, maybe it's because I hadn't seen the dinettes yet.
So what is interesting about them? What on earth did you write about?
Well, people, you know, it's fun, and we all know this when we're talking to people, when there's that shift in somebody's voice when they're talking about that thing that they really care about. I mean, I know you do this all the time, but and when you get past the prepared answer and into what really makes somebody excited and what makes them tick, and we all have that, and actually it's in the work I do now. Everybody has something, and that may have gotten buried pretty deep, but it's in there.
Well, I'm going to get to that, because I think that's precisely what it is. It's finding the passion in everybody and not seeing them as homeless people, but people who are homeless. Mm-hmm. Understanding that is probably key to it. I want to get there, but I also want to take us on the journey, because you were you an activist at the time? Were you involved in any of these things?
Oh, no. No, I was, you know, I graduated from college in 1971. I was in college from 67 to 71. There may be some people in the room who remember that period. I spent 4 years really confused. And all the more confusing, my father was the dean at Dartmouth College during that era. And Dartmouth was one of the men's colleges where he was taken out of his building at 3 o'clock in the morning, and a lot of drama. And I certainly didn't agree with the Vietnam War. I certainly didn't agree with the way the world was, but I loved my father. Mm-hmm. My grandfather and my uncle were both lawyers. There was a great respect for just orderliness and the rule of law and the best things that America stands for. So I kind of waffled around for 4 years saying, well, you know, I kind of wish things could be different, but I kind of don't know that we're going about it the right way. And so I was not an activist. And I suspect that I was not in the minority. I think, looking back on the 60s, I think confusion, the state of confusion. Although, I will say that a couple of years ago, I got to be in the 4th of July parade as part of the progressive Greensboro contingent. And got to fulfill one lifelong dream. I got to be a beauty queen in the back of a convertible, waving. And I got to wear a sash that said, Miss State of Denial. So I was practicing to be Miss State of Denial and Miss State of Confusion a long time ago.
Would have been better if you're on the back of a bike, but okay. It's close enough. Well, your daughters weren't confused. By the time they became teenagers, they had set a goal for themselves, I guess, of becoming anarchists.
They were the cats who walk by themselves. They were two, I don't know where they came from, but they were. We certainly valued critical thinking in raising them, and I remember thinking how well I was insulating them against making mistakes in life, because they just were going to think for themselves. I didn't realize that meant think for themselves. I thought that meant kind of think like me, but think for themselves. But as they got into their adolescent years, they both refused to get with the program in their own different ways. Isabel, my older daughter, was very academically adept and went to Columbia, went to New York, and and had, was already beginning. Actually, she was volunteering with Food Not Bombs in high school, and then when she got to New York, of course, is a great place. She was, she went up there in 97. So, and the end of the 90s and the 2000s were a time of a lot of activism kind of coming back, and she was very involved in that. And so I was learning from her and learning the academic side of things. She was very involved in protecting a community garden on the Lower East Side that was being bulldozed down by a developer, and protecting people who were squatting on the Lower East Side, and then helping to establish community gardens. And she had a lot of the theoretical underpinnings behind it. We spent a lot of time arguing. And,
well, apparently she won you over, because we'll talk about how much you learned from your daughters and the rest of your journey as our conversation with Liz Seymour continues, Executive Director of the Interactive Resource Center, a day center for people managing homelessness. And Greensboro's premier rock band for kids, Big Bang Boom, is also with us. They're going to play us out of this segment on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us on the State of Things. Here's Big Bang Boom. This is the State of Things, broadcasting today from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest today is Liz Seymour. She's an anarchist, activist, mother, and writer. She helped start the Interactive Resource Center, which is a day center for people managing homelessness. And she's now the IRC's executive director. She wrote about her journey from middle-class mom to anarchist activist for the New York Times in 2006. We'll find out how all of that came about. Before the break, we talked about how your daughters introduced you to this, and you became interested in the anarchy and anarchist community here in Greensboro. Tell us about that.
First.
Let's do it, to define what it is.
I know anarchism, in a lot of people's minds, I think I can see it in the thought bubbles over a lot of your all's heads, is what? Or even anarchist equal sign nut job. And it's probably a good time to clear that up. Anarchism, if you look at its etymological roots, it doesn't mean no rules, it doesn't mean no order, it just means no rulers. It is horizontal rather than hierarchical. Probably the most successful and influential anarchist organization in the world is Alcoholics Anonymous. 12-step programs work with on consensus, with people coming together, with no leaders, and the power of the group. And that's really all anarchism is. Thoreau, most of Thoreau's writing was anarchist. Emerson, Whitman, a lot of the things that we read in school. As I was learning more about it, especially from Isabel, my older daughter, I suddenly had a picture in my mind of every spring high school students crossing across a stage all over America and being, after having taken American literature and having passed all these tests and having done the SAT and so on, and having the principals hand out the diplomas and saying, just kidding, just kidding, just kidding. Because we are taught all these ideas. We are taught to believe in the power and the value of the individual and the greatness of the human spirit and the ability of us as a group to work things out. That democracy is on a continuum. There's representative democracy, and then there's the kind of democracy that most of us live in most of the time. When you're with a group of friends and deciding where to go for dinner that night, you don't say, well, let's elect a leader who will then choose where we go. You all sit and you kind of work it out. We actually live more of our lives in an anarchist world in its most most classic sense.
And our particular form of democracy, too, naturally, by its form, polarizes. And so what you have are these dyads all the time, either or, and no real forum for discussing what it is we really want, not either this or that. Who gave me that choice, right? And then the question, what do I really want, and who asked me? That's really not present in this form of democracy that we have.
Well, when Isabel and I were having one of our many long arguments when she was in college, and she was as those of us who discover that we are willing to use the word anarchist, you generally start out pretty rigid, and like any other ism, it can be kind of rigid. And so she was a pretty rigid anarchist arguing with me, and I was a pretty rigid, confused person arguing with her. And at one point she said, Mom, just think of it as like Quakers who swear a lot. When I wrote about years later, when I wrote about the anarchist collective house that I had then set up, I quoted that in the article that I wrote about it in the New York Times, and I was surprised at the number of Quakers who came up to me and said, I swear. So no disrespect to all you Quakers. You can swear like sailors. I understand. It's fine.
And at its root, it understands, or I think believes and has a faith that human beings, if put in a room, can actually work out their problems face to face on a scale and a scope that is human and not inhuman.
Right. And as I said, we do that all the time. We just don't put a label on it. I would say of all the political philosophies, it is probably the most spiritual because its fundamental basis is on the goodness of people and the strength and resilience of the human spirit. And a lot of political philosophies that we've developed over the years are kind of cynical. They're based on the presumption that people will act out of their own self-interest and not the interest of the group, or that people are not very smart. So anarchism is just another way of getting at that. It has somehow taken on this whole other side to it. So,
well, it's come to define chaos, unfortunately, the word itself, and that's part of the problem.
Chaos can be kind of cool sometimes, too.
Because you've got to work your way out of it one way or another. So you're now working your way through these philosophies, you're having these arguments, and slowly being, in a sense, I guess, won over. So tell us what happens when your daughter Margaret introduced you to Justin.
Well, can I go back a little
Sure.
bit before that? Because in August of 2000, my daughter Isabel was a college student. It was a summer break for her. And she was in Philadelphia protesting at the Republican National Convention. That was now, 12 years ago. And she was arrested. And 420 people were arrested, actually, before the convention began. She had been standing on the street with a walkie-talkie. She hadn't been doing anything. There wasn't even anything to be done yet. But because she was holding a walkie-talkie, I think they looked on her as an organizer, and she and 420 other people were herded into buses and sat there in the sun for about 4 hours before they took them off. And all the people who were arrested followed a tactic called jail solidarity, where nobody gave their names. They all went in under as Jane Does and John Does. And often what happens is that when you arrest that many people all at once, it's just the judge just says, you know what, these are misdemeanors we're talking about. This is just too much trouble. Just go free. Not in Philadelphia. 11 days in jail. She was, and with no word to us. So all we knew is we got a call from somebody who said, I can't give my name. I just want to let you know that your daughter's been arrested and she's fine. Oh, thanks. And then no word. And I kept checking the internet and reading about it, and the word that was coming out was that the conditions were really brutal. And we finally heard from her. We got a letter from her, and on the day we got the letter, she was released. We hadn't gone up there, and we hadn't bailed her out because we did hear that this was something people wanted to go through. They didn't want, as an activist, she didn't want to be bailed out by her parents. She was in a jail cell meant for one person. There were six of them in there, and they had all been wearing tank tops and shorts because it was August in Philadelphia, and the air conditioning in the jail was turned way, way up. All the jailers were coming to work in their winter jackets, and one guy came in one night and just handcuffed all of them, right wrist to left ankle, and left them there that way all night. I knew even before that kind of thing went on. I knew that there were unfairnesses in the system, but it had never happened to me before. That changed me a lot. That whatever arguments I had had with her saying, well, you know, it may not be perfect, but it's the best. I thought, this is wrong. And I remember feeling heartbroken and bigger and feeling like this is the first time that I've felt angry in this way, and that this is actually an anger that I'm going to do something with. And I think that has stayed with me ever since. And then on top of that, then my daughter Margaret was, she was not with the program in a whole other way. Leading up to turning 18 and starting hopping freight trains around the country for a couple of years. So she was introducing me to a wild and woolly edge of life that I had never experienced myself. So that was
Did you, now when you found out about this, I mean, what do you do as a mom? Do you try to stop her? Do you realize it's too late? What do you do?
No, we ended up, actually, we were the ones who dropped her off at the train track. I mean, at a certain point, what do you do except buy them a backpack? And this was long enough ago that it didn't occur to us to get her a cell phone. Cell phones in those days were kind of big, bulky, weird, expensive things. But right before she left town, she did replace herself, or she left a gift for me. She had been living with some friends or staying with some friends in an apartment near the university in Greensboro, and this young kid had been sleeping on their sofa. And she called me and she said, "Mom, I don't, you know, we're about to leave, and I know he's a runaway. I don't know what to do. What should I do?" And I said, "So, you know, even if you're about to hop freight trains, you do call your mom." And when something goes wrong. So anyway, I came, and that's how I met Justin, who, to make the long, very long and winding story short, is now my 25-year-old son.
But we're going to have to tell a little more of that story, because at one point you thought the solution to this would be to bring him home and raise him, right?
Well, I did. That Friday, I had volunteered many years before with something called the Guardian Ad Litem program that some people in the audience may be familiar with. It's a wonderful program where you are trained as a court-appointed advocate for children who are in the system. And I, in questioning Justin, who was this angry, resentful, peroxided, blonde 13-year-old who didn't want to say much about himself, I said, I recognized that he, A, was a runaway, and B, probably either had a guardian ad litem or qualified for one. So on the strength of that, I brought him home for the weekend. Bill, my then husband, agreed, and Justin came home. That night, he lost his last baby tooth. And I went in and I sneaked into he was staying in Isabel's room because she was off at college, and I put a quarter under his pillow, And Monday, I called the guardian ad litem office, and they said, you need to bring him down. They said, oh, you know, we're so glad he's safe. He's been gone for about 2 weeks. You need to bring him down, but don't tell him that there is a what's called a secure custody order out on him. The judge has ruled that when he's picked up, he has to go to juvenile detention. So I put him in the car, and I said, no, it's going to be fine. Oh, it's a weird... Thinking, oh, I got in the car and he turned to me and he said, "Will you adopt me?" And I said, "No, oh no, I can't do that. But I will certainly take you down to the courthouse." And as we walked in, he said, "This feels like a trap." And I thought, "Oh, great." We walked in and spoke to his guardian ad litem. They were so nice to him. And then she said, I just need to go. And two big security guards came in and started lecturing him and saying, "Son, you're never going to amount to anything." He was just sitting there with this gap in where his tooth was gone, crying and crying and crying. And finally they put him in handcuffs, and the only thing that we could get them to agree to was to cuff him in front instead of in back, because it's more painful in the back. And then this little guy went off between these big two brown-suited security guards, and I thought, I don't know if I want to live in a world where you can lose your baby tooth and go away in handcuffs in the same 24 hours. The world that I grew up in works really well for me, but it doesn't work for everybody. So that was another big change, a radicalizing moment for me, that I can't just go on reaping the benefits of having been born at the top of the pyramid. I've got to do something.
You're being radicalized. You're coming along. Your husband is not.
Well, he's a wonderful teacher.
Yeah.
He's doing great work teaching. But
you had to somehow resolve this at home, right?
Well, we after a year or two of more than a year of working with Justin and trying to find something in the system and having him, he was a runner, so he would they'd put him in a group home and then he'd run, and then he'd put him in a group home and then he'd run, and so I added up, he spent 80 days in one calendar year in juvenile detention, which is this awful place out by the airport. I finally concluded that and the clock was ticking. Justin was going to turn 16, and then he was going to turn 18, and without any stability in his life and with more severe legal consequences. So finally I said to Bill, I need to be Justin's foster mother. And he said, you know, I can't go there with you. I said, I know. So that was 10 years ago.
And you essentially, you kept the house. You did divorce and kept the house and turned it into a group home, essentially, right?
Well, we don't say group home. We say collective.
A collective. That's right. A horizontally governed collective.
Right.
With a mortgage.
Right.
So tell us how this leads you to your thoughts on homelessness and the creation of the IRC.
Well, step by step, really. I think it, in some ways, I got to thinking, the IRC, for those of you who don't know, is a day center, a day resource center for people in Greensboro or in Guilford County who are homeless or trying to keep from becoming homeless. This is the lunch speech that you were trying to avoid. We've been around since January of 2009, but only in downtown in a big building since May of last year. We see over 200 people a day now. There is a lot of need, a lot of homelessness in Greensboro and in Guilford County. I developed in working with Food Not Bombs, which is a horizontal organization that feeds people, and dumpster diving. I did, in the collective house, that we did a lot of dumpster diving. Let me tell you guys, there's a lot of food out there.
I have to get you to tell the story. You were dumpster diving at UNCG.
Well, yes.
And got kicked out.
Well, yes. I wasn't in the dumpster that time. before my younger daughter, Margaret, hit the road, a friend of hers, because I was saying, well, what do you mean dumpster diving? Like, I'm not questioning, I'm not doubting that you find this stuff in the dumpsters. It's just hard to believe. And he said, okay, well, just let me show you. So we went on the UNCG campus one night, and I held the flashlight and a little notebook, and I wrote down everything, because I kept saying to myself, you know, I'm not really interested in this. I just might write about it sometime.
Mm-hmm,
I
was, mm-hmm.
I'm just collecting, you know, this is just research. So he was in the dumpster, and he was going like, oh, man, look at this almond butter. Oh, great, we found some cereal here. Oh, look, this sweater, there's just a little burn on it. And suddenly the night lit up because a squad car had pulled up. And I was there with my notebook, and I was saying, oh, yes, officer, no, I'm actually just here doing the thing for the with the, but, and he said, well, can I see your ID? And I said, well, okay, but I am just really, and he wrote us tickets saying that both Margaret's friend and I were not allowed on the UNCG campus for 6 months, which was a little awkward because I was the chair of the Friends of the UNCG Library at the time.
But did you offer to bring snacks to the next meeting? I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break. I want to come back. I'm good. We're going to hear Big Bang Boom, which is the band that is here, and they're a hugely kid-friendly band. We're going to hold you over, Liz. I've got a few more questions for you, so we're going to take a break, come back, talk to Liz a little bit more, and then we're going to hear the band, which you're going to hear right now as we take a break on the state of things. Big Bang Boom, going to reveal the secret for delighting both kids and parents, all that when we come back. Here we go.
Got myself out of bed, I got dressed like you said. I brushed my teeth and you brushed my hair. In the car and down the road, hope to find some friends I know, cause I don't know what I'm supposed to do. We're here, it's the first day of school. I wanna go home, I wanna stay. Dad, why can't you play here with me at school? I'm so scared, it's my first day, and I just wanna say, hold my hand and tell me what to do. I'm a kid on the first day of school. I'm a kid
on the first day of school. Don't know what I'm doing here, I'm feeling like a fool.
Out of bed and I don't know what to do. Well, I'm a kid on the first day of school. I have some fun, I think I'll go. Made some friends, some I know. These shoes of mine, they really aren't so cool. Teacher, you know she's not mean. Silly songs I learned to sing. Paper, scissors, notebook, and glue. Like a kid on the first day of school. I'm a kid
on the first day of school. Don't know what I'm doing here, I'm feeling like a fool.
I went out of bed and I don't know what to do. I'm a kid on the first day of school.
This is the State of Things coming to you today from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stasio. And I'm talking with Liz Seymour, who's the executive director of the Interactive Resource Center, a day center for people who are managing homelessness. So before the break, we went through your journey into political consciousness, I guess. You founded the IRC. It's a day center, or you've helped to get that created, and I know a lot of good people were involved in doing it. Tell us about a day center and why that's important in a community, what it does, and how it's different from shelters.
Well, if you think about any day, any one of us has 24 hours in our day, and think about what you what you use your home for. It's not just a place to sleep. It's not just a place even to get meals. It's a place to shower, a place to sit when you're not feeling well, a place to keep your stuff, and a place to feel at home. And many communities have a day center of one sort or another, and I think they're really important for every community, because if you don't have an explicit day center, you have an implicit day center. In Greensboro, it has been the bus depot, the library, parks, and all those are certainly good places, but their function, their mission is not to provide a home for people during the day. Their mission is for people to get on and off buses or take books out of the library. It's been clear for a long time that Greensboro needed a day center, and I was involved. My experiences with Food Not Bombs, I had gotten to know. One of the things about Food Not Bombs, the feeding program I was involved in, is that anybody who wants to can come and cook as well as eat. So I got to know a lot of people. I think a lot of you probably know that there's no better way to get to know somebody than standing in the kitchen next to them chopping onions together. And so I got to know people, and I got to know more about their lives, and got to understand probably more deeply and more poignantly than I ever had before that every single one of us is an individual. Every single one of us is living 24 hours of ups and downs, that we are all living in webs of relationship, that we are all important. I remember once actually driving Isabel back to college, and I was telling her this theory, and for once I was the one arguing for something, and I said, "No, Isabel, you have to understand, everybody has a rich interior life. Everybody is leading a full 24 hours, no matter who." And we pulled into a gas station, and she said, "Mom, even that guy?" And I looked over, and there was some guy pumping gas, and I said, "Yes, even that guy." But that is very important, and that's important for us to honor. And so the day center that we've created, and when I say we, that means the whole community. A lot of the ideas and programming from the very beginning came from people who are on the street. So we have shower, laundry, a place for people to get mail, place for people to make phone calls, to sit, but also a computer lab where people can get help looking for work, housing office, see a nurse. We do a lot of what we do in partnership with other groups in the other agencies in the community. So we can kind of turn on a dime. If people came to us and said, "You know, we really want to learn tennis," it would be our job to go out and find a tennis professional who would volunteer. And then when they came and said, "We're feeling pretty good about our tennis game, but now we're more interested in dog grooming," our job would be to then find dog groomers who would come in and help people. So it is a community collaboration. A lot of people kind of stumble over the name, the Interactive Resource Center. That was actually suggested by somebody who was living on the streets. He said, "Don't use the word homeless. There's much too much stigma. Don't use the word shelter. Don't say refuge or hope or mission or any of those things." He said, "It's going to be interactive. It's going to have resources. It's going to be a center." We said, "Okay."
Liz Seymour, the Executive Director of the Interactive Resource Center. What a pleasure to talk with you. Executive Director of the Interactive Resource Center in Greensboro. For more information, you can check out gsodaycenter.org.